This is part two of the success call with Sean Cunningham.
You mentioned the possibility of repairs, either when you buy a property or unfortunately if a tenant does some damage. Do you oversee those repairs, and how involved are you, and do you charge for that time?
That's a great question, actually. It's always been a bit of a struggle for us because to answer your question, we've always overseen the repairs, and we've never charged for it. So it's not, and it can be very time consuming at times to deal with it. But it's just and my brother and I, we've always kind of debated back and forth, and do we want to charge or not? And we just have not done it because we feel it's sort of the marketing pool of our business is to an investor is. We make it easy for you, right? Easy is the word for investors. It's got to be easy. It's got to be simple. It's got to be a little stress. Now, some of our investors will oversee their own repairs because they're just, if their personality type is where they can be overbearing in that regard, then we let them handle it if they want to. But the majority of our clients, we handle the form. And obviously, we have our own network of vendors that we use as well that we know can get the job done. But we'll oversee it for them and get it done, and we don't charge a fee for it. So. It's worked pretty well for us so far in terms of repeat and referral. So we've kind of decided to stick with that. But I know a lot of managers do charge for overseeing repairs, and they're probably not wrong to do that.
Let's go back to that qualifying the tenant. Could you break that down for us? If somebody were to make an application, well, I'm already jumping the gun. Somebody says they want to rent out property A. What's the process that you walk them through?
Well, the first thing is fill out the application, and they have to drop it off with the application fee in a cashier's check and money order form. We don't accept personal checks. One day, we'll be able to accept credit cards where possibly, but right now we don't. It's just cashier's check money order. So they bring it into the office, or they mail it in if they're out of state, and then we run their application, we run their background check, we discuss it with the owner. And this is very important. I can't stress enough the importance of that process, that application process, that point from when you get the application to when you rent the property out, that is where people get sued all day long because there's fair housing is everywhere there. You have to have a repeatable, predictable process that's in writing so everyone knows what it is. The homeowner needs to know what it is. The tenant needs to know what it is. So that process needs to be the same process for every single tenant. So when the tenant walks in, they drop off their application fee. We run their application. It's the same application. We use our own application that's approved through the Board of Realtors. And when they're approved, we talk to the owner. We only talk about certain things with the owner. We do not get into how many kids they have. We're extra careful about fair housing. So we don't discuss anything related to the protected classes. We do not discuss with the homeowner at all. And that by the way has created some real friction with the landlord or the homeowner or the investor, or whatever you want to call them. That's created a lot of friction over the years to the point where we've been very, very, we put that in writing up front and made very clear that we will not discuss with you anything other than their credit score. We'll discuss with you the financial, how much money they make. We discuss those things only with the homeowner to protect both of us because I don't want to ever have, I don't want any idea that we ever have a conversation about protected classes. It's that important. If you don't understand those kind of things, you can get shut down. Really, it's that big a deal.
Let's talk about between the time they write in the application and the time you talk to the owner. What types of things? What kinds of information are you pulling up? You said credit report, background. At some point, you said criminal, and you also said financial. Help me break that out into little pieces. What exactly is that?
Yeah, rental history. We'll request the rental history from the previous two landlords. And the last one is kind of not always useful because sometimes they'll tell you what you want to hear to get rid of them. So you want to make sure you go back to two properties ago to get a rental history report. And also we look at the FICO score is a bit overrated to some degree because in Vegas especially, people do not have good credit. In general. So so many people have gone through foreclosure or short sale that, it's just, if you eliminate people based on foreclosure or short sale, you would never rent a property out. I mean, it's that common. So we have to kind of go through a process where we set aside certain things and look, not just FICO score. We look at a FICO score. If it's really, really low, like, 400, there's major issues there, obviously. You just know that's going to be the case. But we look at also, you know, their history of paying on time for where they live, either through rental history or through the FICO score. If they had a foreclosure or a short sale, we usually set that aside and just look at how much they were paying on the foreclosure. So if their foreclosure payment was, you know, $3,000 a month and they're renting a house for $1,200 a month, then, you know, you just feel good about that. And then obviously we look at rent, income as well, and also job history, how long they've been on the job and how much money they make is the primary thing you look for. Criminal history is something we do. You're looking for, you know, obviously things like, property damage, vandalism, theft. You can look whatever you want to in terms of deciding if you want to rent to somebody or not. You can look at the criminal history report any way you want to look at it. But usually there are things on there like domestic violence, things like that. So you have to kind of the owner decide if they want to rent to somebody with that kind of issue or not.
Let's go back to income. How do you verify or confirm someone's income?
You pay stub, or usually if they're self-employed, you look at tax return, last 2 years' tax returns. You know, kind of like we would. You know, same thing if you're buying a house, you just look at the verifiable income, and you want to make sure they make at least 3 times the rent. And again, that's in Vegas. I mean, I know some markets are, the rents are extremely high. So, you know, our average rent is, you know, $1,213 a month. So if they make 3 times the rent in household income, then they're good to go on the for our purposes. Unless the owner the owner can always override you if they want to. I mean, you always want to give the owner the chance to. Sometimes it can be a very difficult property to rent, and you want to take a chance with somebody. And if the owner wants to do that, then we make them sign off in writing that we advise them against it and that they want to do it anyway. So, and that happens sometimes. I mean, it's still the owner's property to decide what they want to do with it. We're just giving the information that we can give them.
How long do you want to see that they've been on the job?
At least 2 years, if possible. And it depends. You know, it always depends. It's never a hard and fast rule. I mean, if they're in the same exact industry for 20 years and just change jobs, I mean, it's not always a big deal. So you have to kind of use your judgment and look at it that way. And I know it sounds kind of weird to say it that way, but you just have to kind of go based off of what's there. But if there's mitigating circumstances, you need to take that into account as well. But you know, we try not to do that if we don't have to. But it kind of depends. If you got 10 applications on a property, which sometimes we do, it's easier that way. But if you have one application after a month on the market, because it's a tougher one to rent, then you have to really step back and make sure that you. Make sure you can't find any way to get around it. And sometimes maybe where if it's tougher to rent, you may ask for an additional security deposit. If they don't meet all the criteria, you may ask for additional month security deposit or 2 month security deposit. So there are other ways you might be able to mitigate if their application is not perfect and you don't have any other applications.
You've got a lot of properties, 260 properties. That's a lot to keep track of. Do you have software that help you keep track of these properties?
Yeah, we use PropertyWare. WARE, propertyware.com. It's an online-based software. First thing I did when I started property management is get software, which is key. So I always tell people that want to get into it, make sure you get your software up front. Make sure you're paperless up front. Do not keep paper files. It's 2013. And management, if you start keeping management files in paper form, it can overwhelm your office. I mean, it's you know, imagine 260 property binders in my office. I mean, I have to quadruple my office space. So get a good online system, get a good paperless system up front when you start property management is key. And take your time with the system. Our system is used by our entire office. We have a little bit of an odd situation here because our office is almost a property management brokerage in some ways. And we have 2,000 properties in our office that are under management. So we actually all work with the same software program now. It didn't used to be that way, but eventually we kind of all melded into the same software program, which is PropertyWare, in order to handle rents. And we can also do direct deposit for our owner accounts through there, so we can pay owners electronically, which is also very important to do. And also tenants can pay electronically on there as well if they need to, if we try to make them do it now, actually. And also, if the owner needs to send you money for repairs, they can do that through the system. It also allows owners to log in to their owner can log into the website and see their statements 24 hours a day, which is always important when you're discussing what you do for them. That they don't have to wait for a paper statement to come in the mail. You can log in and get it all year long.
Yeah, that was you're starting to get into the area I was going to ask next, which is the flow of money. How are you collecting this rent? Is it in cash, checks, electronic? And then also, how are you paying out the expenses? If you're writing checks for all that, collecting and depositing checks for all that, it seems like it would get kind of laborious. How do you handle that?
It's labor intensive. I mean, no question about it. It's my goal is to get everything, is to never have to write a check. But I don't have full control over that because we run, like I said, we have 19 property managers that run their own businesses and for over 2,000 properties. So it's a little bit different element to what we can get done. But you know, right now our owner checks are e-deposited, so we don't have to write checks to owners. Okay. And when I first started property management 7 years ago, back when we didn't have any of this stuff, that was the first thing I changed is to not mail owners. You never want to mail owner a check for the rent because they'll never get it. It seems like so the owner e-deposit is so key. So when the rent gets paid, we try to get the tenant to pay electronically, which the majority do. We're still not 100%, but the majority of tenants will pay electronically. So the rent automatically goes into the trust account. And then we take the rent, we subtract out our management fee, we subtract out any expenses for the month, and then we send the money to the owner electronically as well. And they usually get it the 12th of the month. It usually takes that long to process all the bills and all the income for the month.
Let's walk through the rental collection side. Do you have all the rents due on the first, and then what happens if the rent's not paid? You know, what's the schedule or the process that happens after that?
Well, on day three, Deborah will call. That's our account manager. She does most property management related items these days in terms of the day-to-day, I guess you would say minutia of property management. She's really, really good, and that's always, you know, that's another conversation, I suppose. But the main thing is on the third, you have to call every tenant that has not paid on time. It shouldn't be a huge number. Sometimes it'll be a situation where it's just an unusual month where maybe the first fell on a holiday or something like that, and people, you know, so it's not always because people are trying to be malicious or just not pay. Sometimes people just don't pay for whatever reason, so you have to call and get the rents in. And if people don't pay on the third, we file the eviction notice immediately unless there's some sort of an arrangement that's been made. But even then, we almost always file the eviction notice immediately because you want to make sure that you preserve the owner's legal time frame to evict the tenant if you have to. And also, it forces the tenant to understand the importance of paying the rent on time. There's nothing that makes a tenant pay quicker than a notice on the door of eviction. But you know, you don't want to post those if it's just a oversight. So that's why you make the phone call first and try to get verbal arrangement with the tenant to get the rent in the same day. On day four is when you really are filing the eviction notices.
The rent is due on the first. If it gets to the third and you haven't received it, you make a phone call. If it gets to the fourth, you start to file the paperwork to start the eviction.
Yeah, we post a notice immediately. I mean, and that's done through a third-party company. You post a notice on day four if you don't have the rent in. And like I said, it's rare. It's extremely rare we evict somebody. But that notice, if you haven't made an arrangement, the most important thing to keep in mind with tenants not paying is when they don't respond to communication is when you have to do that. So, I tell, when I used to do all the lease signings, I always would tell tenants when they walked in, I always tell them that the only reason people get evicted is if they don't communicate. And that's what's really true. You would never evict somebody if they're responding and people don't communicate and they try to, bury their head in the sand. You got to post a notice to kind of bring them back to reality. But most tenants, if they don't pay on time, can be dealt with. Just through a phone call, you can deal with it and get the situation resolved. And if we file a couple eviction notices a month, we probably only do a couple evictions a year. So it's not a common thing, but you have to make sure you follow. The most important thing in property management as a property manager is to make sure your systems are as predictable as you can make them. That way there's never any, concerns that you're treating tenants differently for whatever reason. So, if your system is to file eviction notices on day four, you want to try to make sure you do that to maintain the same system, over and over again. And then you have to go to court, which we do on occasion for whatever reason. It's better if your systems are clean, if you have a lot of notes, and if you have verification of what you've done, so you can show that if you have to go and fight a tenant about, whatever reason.
When do the late fees start to kick in? Is that on day four?
Yes. Yeah.
What expenses are associated with property management?
You mean my expenses?
Yes. You as the operation, the business of property management, what expenses do you have to run that?
Well, the beauty of property management is that it is labor, labor is mostly all labor. We pay money to, we have a full-time assistant, Deborah, who's really good. We pay her really well. She does she's not, a 9-to-5 worker. She'll do what she has to get the job done. So we pay her well. We give her bonuses as well. That is the majority of the expense. It's going to be labor and property management. Because if you pay for something, with regards to a property, you charge it to the owner. So if I put a sign up, if I have to put a for rent sign up at the property, which we don't do a ton, if we have to do that for a property, we charge that cost directly back to the owner for a sign company. If we have to send a courier out to do something, we charge it back to the owner. So in property management, you can charge to the owner the cost you incur, and then it's a labor intensive business. So, and our situation is different than most I've encountered, because we do so much in a centralized fashion through the office, which is not common, especially for REMAX. So we do a lot through the office. So I pay the office a lot of money, but that part of that goes towards the work they do in terms of handling things that, if I were an independent agent, I would have to pay for myself, or independent brokerage, just to say, I have to pay for myself, like a reception at the front desk, or some of the financial items that are handled, they do through the office.
That's interesting. So, yeah, you mentioned the brokerage seems to have a focus on the property management.
It's funny how it works. It's funny. I started property management 7 years ago, and everyone told me, don't do it. You're crazy. You're gonna get sued, including the broker. And then once we started doing, well, I mean, other people too have done really well with it, and it kind of exploded. And now we have, like I said, I think we have 19 property managers last I checked. So it's a big operation. Our office has essentially become a property management firm. We do a tremendous amount of sales, but it's just, you know, property management can tend to overtake things because it's so, especially the first of the month, because there's so much labor involved with it. So, you know, first of the month, this place is a rent collecting facility, basically, instead of a real estate office. So that's the way it is. I mean, it's fine. That's the way it is. I mean, it's a good business if you know what you're doing.
Well, if somebody were thinking about starting a property management division or part of their brokerage operation, what are the downsides? Is there any downside to being in the property management business?
Yeah, there's a lot of downsides. It's funny you say that. One thing I would say, property management is litigious, meaning that you most property managers I know get sued a lot. They get taken to court for dumb things. And you know, when I was trying to get into property management, you know, 7 years ago, in fact, it was at Star Power at the conference, taking a property management chat, you know, a little chat session. And I remember, you know, Nate Martinez, I love that guy. He's talking about how many times you got sued in the first year. And funny enough, of course, I came back home and immediately wanted to start the management business, because I understood once you understand what the pitfalls are, that you can't, if you don't have the time to be personally involved in the launch and in development of the business, property management business, then I would not do it, because you can't just start and delegate the whole thing off. Because it requires someone who really understands the value of the little things. And most usually when you hire people, even if you have like a really anal assistant, they don't know enough about the legal side of it to do everything right. So you have to make sure you really stay on top of them early in the process. And so when I started property management, I was still doing sales, and I didn't have any, you know, I didn't have any staffing for it. So I had staffing for sales. So my sales assistant at the time did a lot of the property management. And it was a messy, the first couple of years were really messy because we were doing so well. It's funny that I took like 70 accounts in the first year. And we were doing so well that, you know, I took on anything that came in. And it was a big strain on the business, but I didn't get sued, and I didn't get taken to court. I made mistakes, of course, and I had to pay for some of them, but I didn't have to deal with the lawsuits because I was on top of everything. I made sure I understood what the actual processes were before I started hiring off staffing for property management. And eventually, my brother came on to take over the majority of the workload in property management as the actual licensee property manager. But I didn't do that until a couple years in, when I actually knew what the business was. And so 7 years later, we only had one lawsuit, which was over, you know, just over, you know, it was like a little, it was just a stupid thing. So it was a tenant sued us because the owner went into foreclosure, which is kind of funny. So it cost us like $5,000 in legal fees to get rid of it. So it was very annoying to deal with, but that's the only lawsuit in 7 years. I know many that get sued multiple times a year in property management for share housing, for all kinds of issues. And it doesn't matter if you do something wrong or not. It matters if you keep your systems. If you don't have the mindset to have systems that are repeatable, that are trackable, if you don't have the ability to keep notes of what you do, I would not get in property management, because when you go to court or someone tries to sue you, and you can't show, you know, that you did this, this, and this, that's when you get sent to court and you lose more often than not. And we, when tenants try to take it to another level, and we can show them our detailed notes of what we've done, and we just show the contracts that we have that are designed to, you know, to preempt issues. That's why we avoid going to court, because, you know, they can't win. I mean, our situation is so clean and simple that, and they have nothing but their, you know, but their word to go on. You asked me what the pitfalls of property management are. The one other thing I want to make sure people know is that if you're starting a property management business, you need to have the, if you're an overly emotional person, and you tend to, you know, you're not someone who can sit in front of someone who walks into your, if someone walks into your office and says to you that they, you know, had a horrible medical situation come up and they can't pay the rent and they don't know what they're going to do. If you're the kind of person that can't do your job in that situation and you're going to become emotionally involved with every single tenant, it's not for you, in my opinion. It's just not. And I'm not saying I'm not an empathetic person. I mean, it's not my personality type is to focus on the facts and the contractual obligations, as opposed to the emotional, you know, interactions of each person you deal with. And tenants, the reason people need you as a property manager is because they can't have that conversation either. I mean, it's like, you know, homeowners can't sit with a tenant that they're renting out to and actually hold to the lease when a tenant starts crying in front of them. And that's why most people that don't have property managers have a, you know, unfortunate experience with a tenant where they get taken advantage of. And I've seen it frequently. So as a realtor, that's a valuable skill to have, to be heavily empathetic. But as a property manager, you need to be more, a little bit more, I don't want to say harsh, but you got to be more focused on taking care of your client first, as opposed to making the tenant feel better.
Well, let's do this. Let's switch gears and talk about your team. Tell us who's on the team. I'm looking for positions, titles, and then also what each of those positions does.
Team is, we have three. My brother, Kyle, is the property manager. Lee, the lead property manager, he handles 99.9% of property management. So that's his job description. He does work with investors also, actual buyers now. He's got more into that now as we've gotten a little bit more advanced in our operations. So he does that. I do all the selling. I do the listings and buyers as well. I do all the listings. I also do buyers. And then Deborah, who's our account manager, is sort of the right hand for us. She's, you know, essentially does everything, really. I mean, it's kind of, she's a lot on her plate, to say the least. She's actually a former client of mine who I hired. And she actually is the more sensitive type, if you will. So she kind of fills in our personality gap in that way, where, you know, she's more of the person that will have a heart-to-heart conversation with you and she's great for our business. I mean, our clients love her. She does a great job. She's now focusing more on property management almost entirely, and I've outsourced to a virtual assistant some of the sales paperwork elements of what she used to do, so she can focus more on property management. And then we have a part-time college student that helps me out with marketing-related issues. And that's the entire team. We have three full-time people. We have a part-time virtual assistant and a part-time college student that helps us.
The virtual assistant, is that someone in your office, around your office, across the country? Where are they at?
She's out of state. It's just someone I know. It's just out of state. Just someone I know. It's not a, you know, there's no company or anything. She's an extremely anal retentive person, which I was looking for someone who would be so anal retentive that they would annoy me. And thank God she does. I mean, I love her. she's the kind of person that keeps our paperwork in order. And so that's what I wanted out of her. She just does paperwork. She make sure that we have what we need so we can get paid when the deal closes. So that's all. I mean, it's an out-of-state lady. She's a stay-at-home mom. That's all she does for us. And, you know, she doesn't, you know, she probably works, you know, 10, it depends on how many closings we have at the particular point in time. But we pay her, you know, on a contract basis. So we don't, you know, she's not an employee. We have two employees. We have one full-time, one part-time employee. Everybody else is anything else we pay is just, you know, independent contractor work. My biggest, you know, thing, you know, this is maybe a tangent, but the biggest thing is that I used to have four assistants back in the day, like 7 years before I did property management. I had a lot more staffing, actually. It was a funny thing. And when the market tanked, we actually kind of, people left by attrition, so I never had to actually get rid of anybody. And then when we kind of restructured the business, I learned the value of people. I mean, of good people. Like, if you have a really good person, you can actually get a lot more out of them, and you don't need to hire two. So, you know, we actually have less staffing now, and we're doing more business than we've ever done, really, right now. I mean, this is, you know, we'll have a record year in 2013, and we have fewer staffing than we've ever had because we kind of have found a way to, first of all, you focus on what your business is. You try to do fewer things so you can do them better. Then also you hire the best people that you can, and then we try to avoid payroll. I just try to avoid payroll as much as possible. So we have 1.5 employees, And then everybody else, we just piecemeal out for you know, to a VA or a courier or whatever it may be, as an independent contractor type stuff.
I've got to assume that by doing that, by having a smaller staff and being more efficient, that makes you more profitable. And I'm sure there are people listening to what we're talking about and wondering the question, is your operation profitable?
it's profitable. I mean, it didn't used to be. It's been a long process for us to. I mean, it's always been possible, obviously, but it was never like it is now. We're making, I made more money. I made more money personally in 2012 than I've ever made, ever made by a wide margin. And our team operation, I guess, we were number one in our office last year. We were number three in the state for RE/MAX, and we still actually have made more money in the past, years back when we had, 2004, 2005, our team made more money. We had two buyer's agents. We had three assistants. So we had a huge staff. So we made more money, but it wasn't until I went through the process of the market tanking, and right when I bought the team is when the market tanked. So that was a great experience for me to kind of have to ride my feet in my pants there. So I have a learning experience. So it wasn't until then that I realized that I can actually do enough in my time to generate more revenue. So I don't have a buyer's agent, for instance, on purpose, which I get in arguments with other agents a lot about that. I do not have a buyer's agent because I prefer just to do it myself. And I'm good enough at it now to where it doesn't require for me to work with a buyer, for instance. It doesn't require me to spend 5 days in the car, like I used to, 10 years ago. I understand enough now to where I can show a buyer 7 or 8 properties at the most, or in the case of an investor, no properties at all. That's the key thing, investors, I don't have to show them anything. So I don't need a buyer's agent. I mean, I could do it myself. Occasionally Kyle will help out with he does a lot of deals now himself too on the buyer side. So, there's not a need for me to have buyer's agents. And buyer's agents, in my opinion, if your goal is to have a large operation, that makes sense. My goal is to have a boutique operation. My goal is to eventually work with just a very small number of clients that are more, they're 100% referral based because they're easier to deal with and they're more enjoyable to deal with. And then you can do more without having to staff up necessarily. So I've learned the value of profitability. So yes, we're profitable, to answer your question. We grossed 570,000 commissions last year, and I took home 142. So that's far. I mean, my brother and I are equal partners, so we take home the same amount of money. So the vast majority of our income goes directly to payroll, which is us. I mean, we're payroll. I mean, he and I are on payroll, so we actually keep we kept $3 out of $5 that our business generated last year, which is pretty substantial for. For a group operation.
I just ran that number you mentioned real quick, and it looks to me like your net profit margin, the profit as a percentage of the gross, is around 50%. Does that sound right?
Yeah. We don't spend money. See, our expenses are payroll. So that's the thing. And again, there's only three people on payroll, and my brother and I, who are 50-50 partners in the business now, where we actually obviously we have the vast majority of payroll. So our business is designed to make us money. I used to care a lot about winning it. We were number one last year in the office, which is exciting for the team, and I like it as well. It doesn't drive me like it used to, where I want to be. I want to be in because I could hire 2 buyer's agents to be Diamond Club every year probably. But I don't want to oversee people. I don't oversee buyer's agents. I want to make money. Period. And I don't mind working with buyers because, after 10 years, I can do it efficiently. So our job is just generating profitability. That's all we look at. We don't spend a lot of money in marketing because we focus on a business that doesn't require you to. And one of the problems I have with real estate as an industry is that people tend to spend money first instead of making profit first. So like this year, we're going to spend more money in marketing than we have in the past because we have the profitability to do so. So, I can spend more, a little bit more money in marketing this year to try to go that little bit next level. And our goal this year is to make $1 million. It's worth $1 million this year. And so we got to spend a little money on marketing to do that. But, the main purpose is to create a referral-based business to where you can keep those expenses low as possible while keeping your staffing low and also generate more profitability.
Yeah, 50% is a strong net. That's fantastic.
Yeah. It'll be more this year, by the way. It'll be higher this year.
You mentioned a few times that you bought the team. You bought a team back in, what was it, 2005 or 6. I'd like to ask you just real quick about that, because people are always asking me how to value a team and then how do you make the payout. So how did you all decide how did you come about valuing the team?
I don't want to talk about that.
Oh, okay.
I'm just messing. I didn't know what I was doing. I bought with a partner at the time who I'm, it's not a partner now. I always tell people that, because I get asked that frequently too, actually, but it's very, very difficult to buy a real estate operation unless both parties really know what they're doing. And we, neither party really knew what we were doing at the time. So it didn't, I survived, I guess you would say, but I didn't thrive for the first few years. I had to kind of make some changes to kind of get to that point. But but part of the problem is when I bought the team is right when the market tanks. So, I bought a team, when the market changes, it's difficult enough to adjust sometimes, usually. But when I'm taking over an operation with people in place, it's tough. So we lost buyer's agents through attrition. Like I said, I never replaced them. So over the next couple of years, we lost our buyer's agents, and I just never replaced them, just did it myself. And we lost staffing, and like I said, went from having 3 assistants to 1, and my partner left as well. But every person that left, it helped me in some ways, if that makes sense. It was a situation where I was able to kind of reset the table, because in some ways it's harder to take over a business that was already ruling because the market changed. So I was able to kind of adjust with the market. I brought my brother in, a couple of years later into the business as a partner. Because I trust him because we have the same value system, which is key when you have a partner. So you have to have the same values where you're, and I'm not talking about, being a good person. I'm talking about your values in terms of what you want to accomplish with the business itself. And, so we both have the same idea in terms of value, what we want to get out of our business, and also how we want to provide service to the people that we work with. So bringing him on was key. So I went through about a 3-year, process of just kind of getting by, really, quite honestly. Until we kind of figured our ways through the market, and it was great. It was a great experience for me. I mean, it's the most valuable experience I've ever had, is not knowing how I'm going to make payroll. I mean, it's one of the things where if you don't know the experience of not knowing how you're going to make payroll and then finding a way to do it, it's like it's not, it's different than taking care of yourself, because, me is easy. When you have other families that rely on you, it changes your perspective on things. And so now I never get stressed about anything anymore, but I never get stressed about things, really anything like that. And we boom. The last 3 years have just been a boom for us. Every year we get better and better and better because we become more efficient. And I always, in my mind, think about, do I need payroll to do it? Do I really, really need to add that payroll? And I don't do it, and we end up being more profitable as a result. And we don't work our people to the bone or anything. I mean, they work normal hours. It's just, we try to, be a little bit more efficient if we can. We try to focus on, what can we do to generate a little bit more revenue here without having to increase our labor responsibilities, if that makes sense. And so, if I have to sell 50 investor homes without showing them, I mean, that's a great way to increase your profit margin without having to hire a buyer's agent, per se, or even a showing agent. So that's the kind of stuff I learned from that process of buying a team and going through the learning curve of running a team. And then, I was 24 when I bought the team. So, it's kind of a crazy thing when you think about it, but it was a great experience. And in terms of answering your original question, because I didn't answer it, how to value a team, I have no idea, really. I mean, let's put it this way. If you're buying a team that I paid for goodwill for the team, which was a mistake, because, goodwill is very difficult to value. I mean, you could pay somebody based on a multiple, like if you're buying a restaurant, like a brick and mortar business, you can pay them based on multiple of revenue. But real estate is not, real estate is so personal in terms of how the business is run. I mean, it's you. It's all about your abilities. I mean, if you're buying a team that's entirely based on based on something that you're not comfortable with doing, then it's not worth it to you. And like even buying a property management business, I mean, property management businesses are very difficult to buy, because if somebody has a management business where every client they've taken on is based on their own way they want to do real estate business, and you take them on and you have people that you don't really have you're not on the same page with, it can be a nightmare scenario. It really can be. And that's why I've learned the importance of building your business from scratch. If you buy a business, make sure you keep if you got to make payments, make sure they're extremely affordable payments. That's a mistake I made too. Make sure they're very affordable payments, to where if you're going to make a payment back to either them or if you take out a debt, in my opinion, when you start a business, you want to avoid debt at all costs, especially real estate, because real estate is not a business that requires you to spend a lot of money to make money. It really doesn't. So if you're going to buy a business to try to get a jump start on it, and you take on a huge payment every month, in my opinion, it's a tremendous mistake. I mean, you're Because you can go, I mean, worst case scenario, you really can go home open house 5 days a week, and you should be able to sell a house, especially if you're in a market like right now where there are a lot of buyers out there. All it takes is you using your brain. I mean, you can go and sell a house without effort. So if you're going to spend a ton of money on buying something, you better get a tremendous return right off the bat.
Sean, what drives you?
What drives me today is different than what drove me 5 years ago. Today, I'm driven by freedom. And, you know, I'm not married. I don't have kids. So I'm not, you know, it's not the same, you know, standard answer you might get. For me, it's more freedom from everything. You know, we grew up lower middle class at best. So, you know, we never had money. So, you know, when I got into real estate at 17, it was a whole different, even just being in our office, it was a very different exposure for me to, you know, people that made money for a living. And, you know, most of my family, all my family, really, they're, you know, outside the people I work with, it's, you know, they're not financially stable. It's a cycle that keeps on repeating, you know, through generations of living month to month, of always being in debt. You always have to have this mindset that you always need debt, but you don't need debt. And, you know, when you go enough debt, one day, hopefully, you realize that, and I came to that realization many years ago. So my what drives me is being totally independent from having to worry about money, per se. And, you know, take care of my family as much as I can as well. I mean, it's not a selfish thing, but I do want to be able to do whatever I want to do without having to do it just to make a paycheck, if that makes sense. And that's what drives me. And really, in real estate, it's a wonderful business to do that, because you have the ability to control your income. And you really do. I mean, it doesn't matter what the market does. It doesn't matter if the market tanks or if it's going up. There's always opportunities and people that need you if you have something to offer, and you can always make money that way. And that's what we've done, and that's what drives me, you know, every day, really. And my brother and I are on the same, with the same value system that way, which is key for a partner. We both want to be free of financial concerns. We both want to retire from real estate at an early age, you know, like the next 5 years, early age. And it's not to me. I don't enjoy real estate, or I don't want to do it. It's just, you know, it's not. If I do it, I'll do it because I want to do it, just purely for, you know, my own, you know, pleasure, if you will, not because I have to make a paycheck, if that makes sense. That's what I mean by retirement. If I decide to work, it's just because I want to, not because I have to. And we're going to be there. We're going to be there actually ahead of schedule at this rate, which is really exciting for us.
Sean, why have you been so successful?
I would say maybe because I take advantage of opportunities when they're available. And, you know, it's, you know, ever since I first got that internship back at age 17, where I was one of, you know, four people that could, they had the opportunity to get it. And I was the only person who applied. That kind of was to set the tone for the rest of my life since, because it's like, you know, sometimes their opportunities are there, but people just don't take it. I don't know why people just don't take advantage of them. And when the market was booming, I took advantage by becoming a partner in the team, when I could have just, you know, asked for $2 an hour, you know, I could ask for $2 more an hour. Instead, I became partner in the team, which was a critical element to making more income at a young age. I was making six figures at 19. So, I mean, the opportunity was there, so I took advantage of the opportunity then. I took advantage of the opportunity to buy the team, even though it wasn't I would say that particular decision was a huge success, but I think had I not made that decision then, that I wouldn't be where I am today, for sure. I mean, that was I had to go through that process, that trial by fire, kind of jumping into being an owner of a business at that stage, to learn the lessons that I use today. So that opportunity was available. I took advantage of it when maybe other people would not have. And then, you know, the market tanks, and we take advantage of the people that are actually available to buy, which are investors. So it's always like, you when the market, there are people in my office, older people who I respect a great deal and who I like, but they see the world in real estate through trying to change the world, you know, trying to, you know, get laws changed and try to fix this and fix that. And I always see it through based on what are my opportunities to provide a service in order to obviously make money. But if you provide a service, you're always taken care of if you're providing a valuable service. So I don't spend time thinking about the world at large, you know, being in you know, the laws I don't like, or the you know, that big rebuilds are tough to sell, or short sales are difficult to deal with. I say, okay, the market needs me to do this, so I'm going to do it. And that's been my attitude for many years in real estate.
If you were going to advise a brand new agent just getting in the business, what would you tell them to do first?
That's what I actually do tell people all the time. And the first thing I would do is go get a database manager. Even if it's it could be Microsoft Excel, if you don't have any money, something on a computer would be ideal. But I would tell them to go get a database management system immediately and type every single human being that you know on a first name basis into that system. and categorize them based on who you know would actually go and champion for you and have the ability to send you a referral. So it could be an ex-coworker, family member, whoever it may be. Try to create categories like I do, which is whatever you want to call them, it doesn't matter, but people that you know who actually has the ability to send you business. Talk to them, immediately take them out to lunch, have a breakfast, whatever you need to do. Make sure they know you're in real estate and that you want them to send you referrals. I found so many people that are new in real estate, it's like they're afraid to ask for business. It's amazing. It's like, well, I'm new, so they're not going to work with me because, it's amazing how many deals I've done in real estate where the client personally knows someone in real estate, like a friend, a family friend. It could be even someone they're related to, and they don't use them. I mean, it's unbelievable. People will use you if you provide a value over anybody else. Doesn't matter who they know. So create that database first off, and make sure that you categorize people. Make sure that you reach out to people that are in that A group or VIP group, and make sure you really make the time to explain to them what you do and that you need their help. And also make sure you make the time to call them and ask them for a referral on a regular basis. And what I would say is your number one priority is to make that list bigger. So if the list is 20 people that you know, or 10 people, it doesn't matter. Your goal is to make that list bigger. And that's why you do whatever you can do for free that makes that a bigger list through lead generation. And if you have to go hold an open house 5 days a week and get 10 people on that list every single week to follow up with, then that's your goal. And your goal is always to get people, get leads to convert to prospects as much as you can and eventually get that list bigger. And my firm belief is the future of real estate is in who you know. It's not, SEO, real websites, all that stuff is great, but the world is getting closer to where people really, they really have the ability to refer. It could be Yelp, it could be Facebook, it could be anything, but your ability to know people is what's going to keep you in business.
Sean, do you think the top agent interviews like the one you're doing right now with Mastermind Agent are valuable?
Oh, yeah, of course. No question. I mean, you have to understand. You have to listen to people that are actually doing it. You know, like you could take a class. I mean, we've all taken real estate classes. But I've always found the most value I've ever gotten was from listening to recordings like this. Just listening to people that are actually doing it every day that are normal people. I mean, we're not, these aren't, the realization I had was that people that are making seven figures in real estate are not all rocket scientists. I mean, some probably are, but for the most part, they're not any smarter than you are. They just take advantage of one opportunity or another, or they heard a great idea, or they take the time to actually reach out. I'm amazed how many realtors don't take the time to go to someone that's in real estate already and ask them what they do, because people usually will tell you. If you ask, I mean, it's amazing how often that happens. But, these interviews are great. I mean, I think they're tremendous. And not just for new agents. I mean, it doesn't matter how long you've been in real estate. You always want to make sure you're kind of staying on top of what other people are doing, just to kind of give you that inspiration of what else you can be doing as well. Because I tell you that, the things that we've done that made the most money were little light and property management. Just sitting in a class listening to a realtor explain everything that went wrong for him inspired me to, start a business that, generates over $300,000 a year. I mean, it's unbelievable. I mean, it's really just that simple. Honestly, had I not sat in that class, I probably would never have done property management. How much did that cost? I mean, really.
Well, Sean, it's truly amazing what we can learn by listening to the top agents. You launched a super successful investor-based business. You recognized the opportunity in your market and jumped to fill the need. You've developed a consistent income stream with your property management, plus huge lump sums of profit through your sales. Your investor-focused model is impressive. I have no doubt you'll hit your seven-figure goal. Thank you again for being our top agent of the month. And join us next call when we talk to an agent who shifted to luxury homes and moved up her average price to the top 5% in her market. Find out who she is on the next Success Call.
You've been listening to Success Calls on the Mastermind Agent Network, where top real estate agents from across North America reveal their success secrets, strategies, and systems in up-close and personal interviews. You can find all the calls at www.mastermindagent.com.